Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. I have to say, there's a sense of deja vu as I was preparing for this oral argument. It seemed to me about 2 years ago
God
that I was...
You have been here before.
Well, I've been here before a lot of times, but I didn't, not often on exactly what seems to me to be a very similar case. It's sort of startling to me that the decision in that coalition was handed down in August of 2010. The rehearing was filed on October 12th. Rehearing was denied on October 25th. The mandate issued on November 9th, and in between
Congress
those times.
Congress changed the statute on what date?
What's that?
And Congress changed the statute on what date?
And Congress changed the statute on July 21st, well before Net Coalition was decided in the first place. So any suggestion that Congress had this case in mind, I submit to you.
I don't care what they had in mind. It's what they did that we're concerned with.
Fair enough. But at the end of the day.
It never caught me looking to see what they had in mind.
I hear that. Judge Sintel, but at the end of the day, ultimately, the question here is one of congressional intent. And did Congress intend, by making a fairly minor change in the statute, which was designed, as the legislative history says, to encourage the SEC to employ a more transparent and rapid process for consideration of rule changes, to in fact create a system that allows the SEC to essentially take inaction, allow a rule to go into effect, under circumstances where this court has categorically stated and done so by vacator itself that the support for the rule under the statute and as required under the record in that particular case is not a valid rule and has to be reconsidered by the commission under these circumstances. It seems to me quite improbable to assume that Congress in adopting this particular change had that kind of a fundamental shift in mind. And indeed, if you look at 19B3C, the language of it and its structure seem quite clearly, if anything, to suggest that Congress actually had in mind the possibility of judicial review of this precise situation, because it says, obviously, the rules go into effect if there's no action taken, although it doesn't even say that. All it just says is that they have 60 days within which to take action. It doesn't have the kind of language we saw in either Nextel or AT&T that talk about deeming something into effect. So this isn't Congress putting it into effect. This is Congress giving the SEC the responsibility to take action in circumstances where there is a substantial issue raised as to the validity of this particular rule under the statute or consistent with the statute.
Let me ask you, you rely on Amador. But you would agree that the statutory language there is quite different, correct?
Well, the statutory language there is different in one respect, to be sure, because it talks about something not inconsistent with law. The language here, though, also says that they're not allowed to enforce the rule if it's inconsistent with law.
It sounds like that would be setting up for review at the enforcement stage, wouldn't it, rather than at the adoption stage.
Right, but the problem with this kind of a fee is there is no enforcement stage. It's one thing if I have a rule that says you're qualified to be a broker-dealer.
What does the part mean that you just said about them enforcing only so far as it's consistent with law?
Well, I think what that language is specifically referring to, and what you take away from it, is the Congress obviously still wants the SEC to be acting available. But the problem is, in the fee context, if I charge you a fee, if I say, look, if you want this data, you have to pay this fee, and I say, but that's way too much money, I have no mechanism by which to have that enforced under these circumstances. The rule is in effect.
Amador, the decision went into effect by operation of law only insofar as it was consistent with the named statute. You have nothing like that here, do you? There's nothing here that says it goes into effect if it just goes into effect if it's not suspended.
Right, it goes into effect, but it has to be consistent with law. And so then the only issue is, did Congress really mean to obviate?
You're back to Judge Rogers' question. Amador has the particular statute that it has to be consistent with, Indian Gaming Act, IRGA.
Right.
That it specifically had to be consistent. There's no such qualifier here. It simply goes into effect.
Right, but the difference there, Judge Sintel, is, I mean, while it is true that Amador had that language and the court relied upon it, the question is does this case fall on the side of the Nextel, Sprint, AT&T line, which is actions that are taken for which Congress expressly provides that they go into effect because things are deemed to be effective under these circumstances, as opposed to this situation where Congress doesn't deem anything. It simply authorizes the commission to take action to protect the interests of investors and consumers. And when the commission fails to take that action, and under the extraordinary circumstances posed here, where they already have a decision of this court that condemns this particular effort, it seems to me under those circumstances quite reasonable for the court at least to open the door enough to look in and say, this is not what Congress would have intended, especially if you look back at the other kinds of cases where suspensions operate and where they're not reviewable. If you go back to the old Supreme Court Southern Railway kind of case where you've got, if you don't suspend, you have a full and complete opportunity for a refund and a hearing and a mechanism available under those circumstances. In that situation, it seems to me perfectly sensible for Congress to, for both Congress to have intended and for the court to conclude that you don't have judicial review in the interim. But here we're dealing with a situation where there is no obvious post-action remedy available. The commission talks about sections 19D and F, which talk about access to the access to services. Access to services is hardly language you would necessarily attribute to be a refund. And it may be.
So that's not an avenue available to you? Is that
well,
your point?
We'll obviously have to follow it if this court says we don't get judicial review here. But I guarantee you that the exchanges will argue that that's not.
To be clear.
But the exchanges are going to tell us it's not available because if you read their brief, they say nothing about that provision, and even the SEC.
Not before us, it's probably one of the reasons they didn't say anything about it, right?
Well, no, except that the commission said something about it, Judge Sentell, and the reason they said something about it was they realized that it's extraordinary to cut off any kind of review and allow monopolistic rates to be charged. I mean, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars since these rates went into effect every year that these exchanges have been able to obtain through this particular through these rules.
What is the effect of the law that lets it go into effect without commission action and specifies that commission action is unreviewable?
Well,
I know you say it doesn't keep you from getting review in this case, but right. What do you think is the effect?
I think what it specifically had in mind was to allow the rules to go into effect, to be sure, immediately upon filing, because in the past, the commission had rules that said certain things go into effect immediately and others don't, depending on whether they affected members or non-members. And the exchanges have been complaining about that, and that's why that language in the provision talking about regardless of whether it affects members and non-members is inserted. And that's the purpose of this, is to say don't make a distinction on that basis. Let the rules go into effect.
The part that says the action is not reviewable.
Right, but the action that's not reviewable takes such action. Such action is action suspending the implementation of the rule. That's the specific action that it talks about. And when it talks about action pursuant to this subparagraph, it says specifically rule change during the period it was in effect. So it's talking about the suspension exclusively. So it's not saying all actions under this subparagraph. It's saying such action under this subparagraph, which I would argue actually is a strong inferential basis for saying that when the commission refuses to suspend, that's subject to the standard.
That action is reviewable, the refusal. That action is reviewable.
Well, that's my view, yes, of course. Yes. But if they
statute says action under this subsection or whatever it deemed it.
Right. Pursuant
it's
to
not reviewable.
Right, but it says such actions, and it talks about actions pursuant to this subchapter. Action in that context is not the inaction of allowing it to go into effect. The action in that context is clearly.
So say you, but why is that clear from the statute that it isn't covering whichever decision the commission makes?
Well, first of all, I think if you read it in context, it's suggesting.
I read it in context.
But
I'm asking you why I should read that as suggesting that.
Right, because action.
One side of the choice is reviewable sub silentio when the generic language says non-reviewable.
I mean, I don't want to quarrel with your last statement because I don't think it's generic language. I think it's very specific.
The only language in there concerning reviewability.
Well, no, but the action shall not affect the validity or force of the rule change. That's suspension. That's action. The action used there, and then it says, and shall not be reviewable. and shall not be reviewable. The only action that shall not be reviewable in that context is the suspension of the rule change. That's, to me, that's the plainest way to read that language. And if, and candidly, if Congress had intended to say that no actions under that subsection are subject to judicial review, it wouldn't have used all this verbiage to begin with. It would have just said all actions are not subject to it. Instead, it used very precise language to say when you're talking about an interlocutory decision, which is to suspend the rule, the effect of which is to then create an entire proceeding going forward that is in fact subject to a final order and subject to a provision for judicial review, it makes sense to say we're not going to allow you to have interlocutory review in that situation. But when you're dealing with what is effectively a final order here, because the inaction here affects rights in exactly the same way as if the commission had entered an order saying we approve these rates under these circumstances and allow them to go into effect. And that clearly would be an order that I submit to you would have been reviewable, notwithstanding the language in this, because that's not the kind of action that this provision says is barred from review by the courts of appeals.
Our intervener suggests all of this is explainable because these fees were non-controversial.
Well, I think the expectation is that the fees will generally be non-controversial. I mean, I think that's what Congress thought was going to happen, is that there weren't going to be serious problems, and probably didn't realize that the exchanges, once given the opportunity to essentially set whatever fees they want for whatever data they want to make available, even, you know, particularly as an exclusive processor there and therefore as a statutorily provided monopolist, they're going to act like kids in a candy store and charge whatever fees they want for everything and its dog.
So is your argument that were we to deny your petition, the only way we could do that logically under the statute would be to acknowledge that you have a remedy under Section 19?
I think it would be pretty remarkable if you said the opposite.
I understand, but just take my...
I think it would be impossible to square the theory of Southern Railway and its reliance on the availability of a full and fair opportunity for a remedy. But I think it's important in that context, Judge Rogers, because, I mean, if you tell us that, that's great. But now we're talking about a remedy that's 2.5 years away while these guys are collecting tens of millions of dollars on a provision that talks about access to fees or access to services, which suggests that if you actually are getting those services, you do have access to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite sure we're going to end up back here in a couple more, well, probably more than a couple, 3 years, fighting over whether or not that's an available remedy under these circumstances.
Well, let me ask you about that, because in the SEC's brief, they point out that N. Ray Bloomberg, who is one of your members, I believe,
right,
used Section 19D. And although that's a very strained reading to me, that is access to services, which comes under the heading of disciplinary action, can be used to challenge not only access to services, but a limitation, through fees, limitation, I guess, through increased fees.
Well, actually, Bloomberg didn't involve fees, as I recall it.
I know
it actually involved access to service.
Saying. And your response to that, I didn't see anything in the reply brief, but you said that 19D, its contours were vague. But we've got this Bloomberg case from the SEC in which one of your members did use 19D.
Right. And look, at the end of the day, if you tell us that 19D is the way we have to go, then that's the way we have to go. But it's pretty clear to me that Congress would not have ever imagined that 19D was the same kind of relief that the Supreme Court relied upon in Southern Railway. But more to the point, even if you take Bloomberg on its face, it's not a rate case at all. So we don't have a decision from the commission that says any kind of fees are subject to relief under 19D. We do have a suggestion that access to services, if you can't get service from the exchange itself under certain circumstances, that they can't impose unreasonable conditions.
Prohibits or limits in person in respect to access to services.
Right, but the question is whether a fee get you there? I mean, that's the only question. And I don't think it's, I mean, look, we clearly are going to take the position that we're entitled to that if you say we're not entitled to judicial review under these circumstances. But it seems to me absolutely clear that if you're looking for congressional intent, that Congress could not have expected that this was going to happen in the way it structured 19B3C, and without having any clue that there was going to be a full and fair refund opportunity at the back end. And under those circumstances, the court should grant the petition.
Do you remember if in Net Coalition 1, I just don't remember, if the SROs tried to do the permissive, tried to go by way of the permissive 3A when it was permissive? In other words, I know we had the full-blown approval, disapproval proceedings, but did the SROs try to go under 3A as it was then written?
My recollection is they did not, but I leave that to my brother, Mr. Scalia. If there are no further questions, I'd reserve the balance of my time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear next from the respondent, I guess. Morning, Mr. Pennington.
Morning, Your Honors. Mark Pennington, representing the Securities and Exchange Commission. With me at council table are Eugene Scalia and Amir Tirani for the NASDAQ interveners, and Douglas Henkin for the NYSE ARCA, which is another intervener. The three arguments in our brief, Your Honor, I think of as three different aspects of the same elephant. And the elephant in the case is there is nothing that happened here that Congress intended to be reviewed. And Mr. Phillips, I'm not sure if it's in his brief, but it never came up during his actual argument when he told you Congress never meant for these rules to take effect without some kind of review. But he never actually quoted what I think is the dispositive sentence in Section 19, which says, the background is, rules don't take effect unless the Commission approves them or there's an exception. And then 19B3A says the rule, quote, takes effect upon filing with the Commission, unquote. Congress could not be more clear that that's what they intended to happen. And it's even clearer than some of these other court cases that Your Honors have had. It doesn't say it takes effect after a period of time during which the Commission can negate it, and it doesn't say it's deemed approved. The Commission's not involved here at all. It says the rule takes effect. And then Section 3C tells us what that means by take effect. It may be enforced by the SRO, not by the Commission, to the extent that it's not inconsistent with the Exchange Act and applicable state and federal law. So that's what Congress has said. Takes effect, and you decide whether it's enforceable and if it's consistent with applicable law, including the Exchange Act, when it comes to be enforced. And as we mentioned in our brief,
Are there SRO rules that are enforced by the Commission rather than the SROs? I was going to ask you about what that first sentence in C even adds to anything, they can enforce it once it's effective.
Well, no, I'm not saying that there's no circumstances under which the Commission enforces an SRO rule, but 99.9% of the time the SRO does. I think the Congress is just saying this is what it means. The SRO can affect it, can enforce it, but only if it's consistent with the law. So the fact that it took effect doesn't constitute an approval by the Commission or, you know, some kind of blessing or make it a super trump card or anything. It just says it takes effect, and the SRO can go enforce it. I mean, if somebody violates it, you can bring an enforcement action, and one of the issues will be whether it's a valid rule.
So in other words, you're saying 3A itself says takes effect upon filing. If there were any doubt, 3C says not only does it take effect, but it's enforceable.
Right, and you can test the validity of the rule in the enforcement proceeding. So the take effect is neutral on whether it complies with the law or not. I think that's the point of the 3C sentence. And as the Commission has said, following up on the Bloomberg case, if someone is denied access but because they won't pay an unreasonable fee, then they can bring a proceeding under Section 19D, which is stuck in there with the heading is disciplinary proceedings, but you see it's denial of access to anybody. If an SRO denies access to anybody, then the person who's denied access can file an application with the Commission, and the Commission can, and then it becomes an actual administrative proceeding, and the Commission can, for example, stay the denial of access. It can impose terms or conditions on the denial of access, but that's all, as Judge Santel said, that's not before us now, but that's the remedy. People are not just stuck and pay the fees forever. So that's how the rule works, and then the statute goes on to say that the Commission may summarily suspend it if it thinks it's in the public interest to impose the suspension and to start a 19B2 proceeding. So to me, the language is very simple. It's very straightforward. There's no language in the statute that establishes a judicially manageable review standard that would say, here's when the Commission has to explain itself. here's when the commission has to issue some kind of formal documentation, and then here's the standard that a court would review the commission's decision under. None of that is found in the language of the statute, which just says that the rule takes effect.
Is this case changed at all by the first opinion?
No, I mean, the first opinion is the court's explanation of what the law is in the D.C. Circuit. Nobody has collected the fees. No SRO has collected fees since the mandate, and nobody's asked for a refund. So nobody's moved to vacate the opinion. I mean, it's just stopped. That stare decisis, I haven't heard anybody say, you know, we could ignore the decision. That's the decisional framework that the commission has taken.
So, just hypothetically, if the decision said the fee can't be can't go into effect because data A, B, and C is missing.
Right.
And then these new rules are submitted,
right,
and there is no A, B, and C. Is the commission then obligated to suspend the rule?
Well,
obligated is a strong word. I
yes,
understand,
it's,
but I was just trying to set it up in sort of a very stark way.
I think that would be the best case. Then you'd have it squarely presented, and as you know, there were
right.
options. And I think maybe an agency, not the commission, that's not what the commission's done here. An agency could say, as a matter of resource allocation, we're just going to let we're not going to review these rules anymore. We're going to let them take effect on filing, and then we're going to resolve them in enforcement proceedings. That's not what happened, but I think that would be the out. In other words, if it looked from the outside like, you know, you're just ignoring what the court said, that raises maybe. But I don't think that's what happened here.
And the argument here is then you're just undermining what Congress intended, since Congress clearly intended that the commission would act in appropriate circumstances to suspend the fee.
Right, and the commission has never indicated that it won't, and it has suspended fees, although not in this situation.
Can I ask you, I guess this would go more properly to the SRO lawyer, but you have a little more time. Under 3A, can you think of any rule change that wouldn't fit that? In other words, it seems to me that 3A renders the whole approval process in 2. In other words, this language is so broad, and if anything weren't swept into 1, 2, and 3 little I's, it would be covered by anything that the commission by rule may specify.
Well, if the commission had specified
right.
the rule, but
I mean, but even without that,
there's lots and lots of these are originally, I mean, before the recent amendments,
right.
these were fees they charged their members and sort of non-controversial technical types of rules.
Well, no, a stated policy, practice, or interpretation.
Right, the SRO is just taking one of its policies and making that into a rule. If you're adopting a new rule of substance, then you have to go through the 19b2. All substantive rules is not a precise label, but they still go through 19b2. These are considered to be.
Where is that clear? Where is that made clear that substantive rule changes go through?
Well, it's the interpretation of the language, and I say stated policy means that they're just taking a policy that they have and turning it into a rule. And you see, for example, Your Honor, in the Bloomberg case, where it wasn't about the fees, but the commission said, no, this is not, doesn't fit within these sort of housekeeping rules, for want of a better phrase, and refused to enforce the rule and sent them over to 19b2. So the fact is, and I don't think anybody's disputing this, or there's any controversy about it, that all the substantive rules that are covered still have to go through 19b2. So this is not.
All right, what would be a substantive rule?
Well, ones that declare, for example, the SROs are required to bar unjust and inequitable practices of trade. So if they were to adopt a rule that defines certain conduct, charging excess.
Why would that be a practice?
Well, see, it's a stated practice. It's right. If you're imposing new obligations, new substantive obligations, then you would have to adopt a rule about it. So this is just if you have a policy and you want to make it into a rule, it's not a change in the law. So that's why I think that the language works. Then I want to talk about the structure of the statute, the contrast between 19b2 and 19b3. If you look at the West compilation of the securities laws that we have, you open it up, and one page is 19b2, and the facing page is 19b3, and they are such different proceedings. The 19b2 is like a notice and comment rulemaking proceeding that you would recognize, or it leads to an order. But there's a process, and it takes time, and there's a record, and it's obviously subject to review by this court. 19b3 just says, as we've talked about, takes effect, go enforce it. Now, the petitioners read that 19b3 language It's saying that under some circumstances, either when every time or when somebody files an objection or when they file an objection that they call a petition to disapprove or when there's a serious dispute about it or when the rule doesn't comply with the statute, sometimes, under some unspecified circumstances, the commission is required to act. And then it's required to explain its reasoning. And then this court has to review explanation of reasoning. And if the reasoning, I guess, is inadequate, the court would say, no, you had to grant the suspension. You have to go to 19b2. And I just can't find that in any of the language of 19b2. And it's reinforced, I think, by the legislative history because, as Mr. Phillips mentioned, it used to be that these kinds of fees that were charged non-members had to go through 19b2. And Congress did two things back in July when they amended the statute, July of 2011. First of all, they put time limits on the commission because people thought we were taking too long. So basically, in the 19b2 proceedings, you have 6 months. If you take all the extensions, you have 11 months, and then it's deemed approved and it has to go out the door. But so if you thought the commission was taking too long on the fees, you just say all the fees have to stay in 19b2 where they already are. But instead, Congress moved them over to this proceeding where they take effect upon filing. And the only reason that I can see why they would have done that was they wanted them to go into effect and then deal with it in an enforcement proceeding rather than have to go through this. As the petitioners read it, what it does is add another layer of judicial review instead of eliminating a layer of judicial review, because first you'd have to litigate the denial of the suspension, and then you'd have to litigate the merits, or you'd litigate the merits during the suspension part. It's not clear to me how they think this works, and because none of it rests on statutory language, there's no guidance for the court.
Can I ask you about 3B, just because how does this commission get wind of a proposed rule change that hasn't been filed? That's the one that says the commission can summarily put it into effect if it's necessary for protection.
Well, that's an emergency thing. The commission, the SEC.
I mean, how does it get wind?
The SRO would call up and say, here's an emergency. Like, we need a rule this afternoon. And they would, and then if the commission agreed with that, then they would put it into place, and then you start the 19B1 process.
Right.
The court has no further questions. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the intervener.
Good morning. Please, the court. Just a few observations. First, I'd like to direct the court's attention to subsection 19B4D, which is addendum page 21. It's the very next page. It's the same statutory section. It's the next subsection. And you'll see D near the bottom of the page shows that if Congress wanted to mandate suspension, it knew how to say it. The commission shall order the temporary suspension of any change of a clearing agency. That's an obvious distinction from the language that we have in front of us just one page before, just one subsection above. Judge Henderson, you asked a couple of questions about how the statute functions, and I'd like to address those. Mr. Phillips has framed his argument to a large extent as if this were only about fees, and as you note, it's not. The immediately effective procedures govern other types of rules, too. This language has been in place in more or less the same form for nearly 40 years. And when Mr. Phillips says that it's the interveners who seek a fundamental shift in law, rather, Congress made a fundamental shift in law when it enacted the 2010 amendments. Petitioners seek a fundamental shift back where, although statement of reasons never, ever had been issued before when the agency did not suspend, suddenly that would be required, not just for fee rules, but all the time. Now, Judge Henderson, previously in the earlier Net Coalition case, the rule and issue there had not been submitted, had been submitted pursuant to what you described as the permissive procedures, because that was the only one available at the time. Congress changed that to permit us to use immediate effectiveness. And then as to what other provisions.
But you all went through the whole approval process.
Yes, and it was quite lengthy. That was approximately a 2.5 year process. And what Congress did was made a couple of changes. First, it required expediting approval, but secondly, moved fees over into a different box to treat them like a broad variety of other types of rules, although petitioners seem repeatedly seeking a fee-specific approach by this court, which isn't appropriate under the statute. In terms of what other things might be covered still under 3A, there are a number of different types of rules. Just one example, listing standards. Those are the standards that exchanges establish for companies that want to list on that exchange. Those are among the most important rules that are adopted by exchanges. Those would still be covered under 3A, I believe. That would just be one example. Just a couple of other observations regarding
That's
this.
An example, you mean of a substantive rule?
A substantive rule that wouldn't be immediately effective, this set of rules that would fall under A. A brief observation regarding the statutory language. I already mentioned subsection 4D, but additionally, I noticed that once or twice when Mr. Phillips was talking about the reference to action at the bottom of C, the immediately effective language, he prefaced the word action with such action. But that phrase, such action, appears a couple of times, but it does not appear when the statutory language is describing the non-reviewability. Then it does not confine it to such action, but rather any action under that section. The word any is not there, to be clear, but nor is the restriction
now, are you on
such.
C? Are you talking about C?
I'm talking about C. The very end of C does not.
Say, even though it doesn't say such, it does say pursuant to this subparagraph.
Right, and their claim is that what they're here to review before this court is action pursuant to this subparagraph. That's where their brief and petition state. I wanted to briefly address denial of access. First, Chief Judge Sentell, as you noted, it's not before the court. Second, it's not essential to the ruling. It was only one of a number of factors considered in the C board case. If you look at the this court's decision, the Sprint case on page 1133, you'll see that there the court said not everything that happens in life needs to be subject to judicial review. We trust that government agents discharge their responsibilities appropriately, and sometimes there's just not review. There doesn't always need to be. However,
you're not conceding that there isn't review here at an enforcement.
Absolutely not. We acknowledge there's authority under Section 21 of the Act for the commission to prosecute action that's not consistent with the terms of the Act. Moreover, under 19C, sorry, there's so many provisions being referred to, but under 19C, the commission has the authority to amend an SRO rule. And if petitioners are unhappy, they can petition for a rulemaking to address an SRO rule. But what's established here is a statutory framework under which the agency has discretion whether to fees will go into effect and other rules, and then can observe them in action. They can go into effect if they're the commission determines they're fine, but sometimes they might permit them to go into effect just because they want to see how they function for a period of time. The statute permits that.
Do you have an example of when the commission has ever amended an SRO rule?
I do not, but the authority is there. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. How much time do you have for rebuttal?
4 minutes
remaining. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Chief Justice Sentell. Just a few points. First of all, Mr. Pennington starts off by criticizing me for not dealing with the language takes effect, but that's not the issue in the case from our perspective. We don't dispute that it takes effect immediately. Congress clearly intended that. We have no basis for challenging that. What we are challenging is the issue of whether or not the commission can ignore its suspension authority in circumstances where the claim is beyond substantial. And for that, we turn to EPA versus Thomas and this court's decision in Hardin, both of which are suspension cases dealing with environmental laws and in which the court recognized that notwithstanding everything else, there is a separate and independent authority for suspension even after something goes into effect. And then with respect to the suspension standard, as such action is necessary for the protection of investors and purposes of this chapter. He says there's no standard to apply under these circumstances. That's a standard to apply that is significantly more definite. And candidly, it seems
Where is
clearly
that language, as you said, we have a number of statutes here.
That's under Part C, where it talks about suspend the changes if it appears to the commission that such action is necessary, appropriate, in the public interest, for the protection of investors, or otherwise in furtherance of the purposes of this chapter. Those are the standards by which the commission is to act. This court has held in the past that the fact that it's the commission may do that doesn't mean that if the commission, in fact, ignores its responsibilities.
Includes the verb may, right?
Right, but this court has recognized in the past in a variety of cases, Hardin being one of them, that the use of the word may doesn't mean that if the statutory requirements are not being satisfied by the agency, that it doesn't have a responsibility to act under those circumstances. The commission makes a pitch about resource allocation and its need for authority there, but then tells you that, of course, we now have this right to bring an enforcement action after the fact. So that suggests that they're going to allocate exactly the same resources at the back end that they claim are impossible for them to allocate in the front end.
I didn't hear them make a claim of impossibility, counsel. I think they were talking about the discretion of agencies as to the use of their assets.
To be sure, he talked about discretion, but he also talked about the ability of the commission to make a decision that resource allocation would be a legitimate basis on which to decide. And all I'm saying is, if they make that claim, it's going to be hard to square with the notion that they're opening up the door on the back end in these particular ways. Mr. Scalia makes reference to 4D, which is at least an interesting effort since that wasn't raised in any of the briefing, and I asked the court to read that because 4D, talking about clearinghouse entities.
Are you sure it wasn't raised in the briefing? Because I know I read it, and it's not like me to read something that wasn't raised.
I don't recall any references to the clearing agencies, and it's important to put in context. Why does it say shall? It's because that's only triggered if an appropriate regulatory agency of that regulates the clearinghouse has already told the commission that there's been a violation of law. In that situation, the commission shall act. So granting discretion in this context and taking it away in that context doesn't reflect that Congress meant to give the commission a pass here. It simply recognized in those circumstances there was simply no basis for the exercise of any discretion. Here, all we're saying is, sure, they have discretion, but they don't have it committed to their ultimate discretionary decisions. Mr. Scalia talks about all of the rules that have been adopted in the past and everything that went with them. But the truth is, there is a reason those rules were never challenged in this context before. And it's because they were minor, and it was because they weren't enacted with monopolistic authority and charging fees that lead to tens of millions of dollars of monopoly rent being paid by my client. There is no purpose to be served by requiring this case to wait for another 2.5 to 3 years when all the court has to do is open the door as it did in Hardin and as it did in Thomas and say, look, this is a suspension that should have been adopted in light of this court's clear ruling in that coalition. Is there no further questions, Your Honors?
Seeing none, the case will be submitted, and you can call the next.